They're having the time of their lives in the paddle boat, singing and dancing as the band plays Swanee River.
Fire! It's in the lamp room, deep in the belly of the ship.
Neglected fire hoses burst. The crew is incompetent. Flammable paint feeds the fire.
Panic. A stampede. The smell of burning hair.
Mothers leap into walls of flame in search of their children.
Life vests disintegrate, having been left out in the elements to rot.
Few can swim, and lifeboats are wired or painted onto the deck. Useless.
The wooden ship is consumed.
And for over 1,000 souls,
there is no escape.
And I'm Owen Mugen.
And welcome to the Angry History Podcast. As you may be able to hear, we are not in our usual studios. We are about...
Thanks to the good Lord in heaven.
We are about 2-3 feet away from each other at McSorley's Old Ale House on East 7th Street in New York City, a place we love and that really was the genesis for this podcast.
Yep. We find ourselves sitting beneath a photo of Vice President Theodore Roosevelt. I see over here above me, oldest tavern in U.S. won't allow women. This place is history. This place is living history. Obviously, if you can get here when you go to the city, do come. You'll see what we mean. The next best thing is go looking at some photos online. But we're here in McSorley's for a special reason. The rain prevented us from going a few blocks away to Tompkins Square Park to a very small, neglected, and I would say little seen memorial for a great disaster that befell New York City in 1904.
In fact, it was the greatest disaster in New York City until 9/11 and the terrorist attacks.
Yep.
We're talking over 1,000 people that died. And again, as one of the things we stress here at Angry History is, these were real people. They had hopes and dreams and all the things that we have. They were sick, they were happy, they had weddings, they had funerals, and unfortunately they had over 1,000 funerals in the area because of this disaster aboard this giant paddle ship that was very well known in New York City, universally loved. People would have come to places like here at McSorley's, and in fact, if you look at the map of where the dead were, they were quite near to here. You'll find quite a few people next door, I believe, that really just cut the heart out of a neighborhood.
Yep, it was the fiery death of the General Slocum. On June 15th, 1904, a sunny day, blue skies, the St. Mark's German Lutheran Church had hired the General Slocum steamboat for its 17th annual picnic to Long Island. It was a weekday, so all but 100 or so of the ship's 1,358 passengers were women and children. Most of the dads were at work, so it was pretty much just women and kids on this trip.
It was just such a huge loss of life.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest loss of civilian life, say it again, up until September 11, 2001. So think about that.
None of the passengers could have foreseen the disaster that awaited them, as that three-story paddle boat cast off from East 3rd Street Pier in Manhattan that morning. But the crew and the Knickerbocker Steamboat Company that owned the Slocum could have and should have prevented the disaster, and that's the thing that really makes us angry.
Yeah, it's one of these things. It's the preventable nature of the horror. Here's an angry history reading of one account of one of the passengers. This is Mrs. Catherine Castlebaum, 52, of 196 Guernsey Street in Brooklyn. She boarded the Slocum that day with 10 family members,
for a day away from the summer heat of Klein Deutschland, or Little Germany. Here we go.
We had a party of 11 on the boat, and were anticipating a fine day's outing. We wanted to hear the music on the way up the river, and so all of us were gathered on the after deck, not more than 20 feet away from the band and close to the rail of the deck. The first intimation we had that there was something wrong was when a scream came from the forward part of the boat. We concluded that someone must have fallen overboard and began scanning the water in the wake of the boat, but we did not have to wait too long to find out what the real trouble was. A few seconds after the first scream, there was a general panic on the forward deck. We could hear the women and children screaming, and an instant later there was a puff of smoke and flame near the bow of the boat. I realized then that we were all in the gravest of peril, and that if we expected to escape with our lives, some of us at least must keep our cool heads. In our party were my daughter, Annette, my son-in-law and daughter, Mr. and Mrs. Henry Schnude, and their two little children, and my daughter, Mrs. Frieda Toneport, and her two children. In addition to these nine, there were the father and mother of Mr. Schnude. The moment I saw the flames, I called all of our party together and told them quietly that if we were to escape alive, we must stick close together so as to be able to help one another. I thought that the strong among us could take care of the weak, but my words of warning were not more than out of my mouth when there came such a rush of panic-stricken people to the stern of the boat that no human being could have stood up against it. I clung to the rail and managed to hold my place, but when I looked around, not one member of my family was to be seen anywhere. They had been whisked away from me in the rush, and I did not know what had been their fate. By that time, there were scores of women and children in the water. At last, I managed to get a foot upon the rail by clinging with my hands to a post. From that point of vantage, I watched the crowd in search of my loved ones, but they were nowhere to be seen. Just then, I saw our pastor, the Reverend Mr. Haas, with his wife and daughter at the other side of the boat. He was trying to protect them from the trampling crowd. Then a minute later, I saw them climb over the rail and all jump into the river together. I took another careful look around to see if any of my family were on the boat, but still they were nowhere to be seen. Then I decided to take my chances in the water. The fire was so near that my hands and face were scorched and blistered, and there were holes in my clothing that had been burned there by the flying sparks. I climbed over the rail and jumped feet first into the water. It seemed to me that I sank hundreds of feet and that I should never come to the surface again. But at last I saw a flash of light, and that told me that I was up where I could get a breath of air. I tried to keep myself from sinking again by striking out blindly with my hands and feet, and did manage to keep up for a few seconds. In that brief time, I saw women and children around me in the water. They all seemed to be drowning. I remember I wondered in a dreamy sort of way if any of my children were near me, and if they would be rescued. Then my strength failed me, and I sank once more. I stopped struggling and didn't seem to care any longer whether I ever rose to the top or not. Just then my head struck against something hard. That aroused my senses, and I grabbed at whatever had bumped my head. I caught it with my hands and held on. Once I got a breath of air, my strength came back a little, and then I discovered that I was clinging to the paddle box. I held on desperately, and a minute or two later, a man in a small rowboat pulled up close to me. The boatman held out an oar to me and yelled to me to grasp it and hold fast. I did so, and he soon hauled me aboard his boat. I begged him to look for the other members of my family, but he had as many in his boat as it would hold and had to go ashore.
For days afterwards, the bodies washed ashore on the banks of the East River. Some of these bodies, there's one account of them setting up a makeshift morgue, and they said there were so many bodies of small children that it just looked like a pile of laundry. They actually took one five-year-old girl and sat her by the door. Nobody thought of the fact that where they were sitting her, she would have to watch child after child after child, dead body, kids her own age, be laid there. And finally she had some tears running down her face, but as kids sometimes do, faced by stress, she fell asleep. And her father came in, was overjoyed, of course, to finally find her. But this is a real human tragedy that we had here. Whole families were completely wiped out. And some of the top families in Klein Deutschland, which is why you never hear anybody say anymore, they had a great night in Little Germany. Nobody would, in New York City would know what you were talking about.
The neighborhood was decimated.
Some of the fathers left behind committed suicide. They'd lost everything. Their wives, their children. One man even took a swing at a policeman who tried to restrain him in his grief. Catherine Castlebaum, whose letter we just heard read, her daughter Nettie, she did find her. She survived the disaster. The 9 other members of her family perished. They were burned by the flames or drowned, including children Mildred, Grace, Francis, and Charlotte. Only 2 of them had lived to see their 4th birthday. In all, 1,021 died, and only 321 passengers survived.
And the Slocum story started out as a happy one. You know, it was supposed to be just a great summer day trip. You know? And it ended burned to the waterline. The boat was named for Major General Henry Slocum. He was a Union veteran from the Battle of Gettysburg. Slocum had represented Brooklyn in the House of Representatives for a few terms, and when the time came to name this new ship, his name seemed like a great fit. The Slocum had been built in Brooklyn, along with the Arizona and the Monitor.
Harking back to the Pearl Harbor episode, the engines of the Slocum were built in New Jersey's own Hoboken, Frank Sinatra's own.
Little representative. Dean is from Jersey, I'm from Brooklyn, so we're both
from by the water and better than Manhattan.
It's true. Brooklyn at the time was its own city then, too, and it became a well-known ship around the harbor, around the East River and the Hudson, from the time it set sail in 1891.
Yeah, that was part of the thing that made the Slocum disaster so touching to people and really hitting them, is everybody knew this ship. People in Hoboken were proud they built the engines. People in Brooklyn were happy that it was built there. People who had seen it have crashes in the North River, as the Hudson River was called at the time, they were proud of it. It had almost run aground in Governor's Island, and they managed to save it. These were dramatic, exciting stories in the time of newspaper accounts.
Yep.
And people really knew this ship. In fact, in a story after the tragic crash, the New York Times estimated that, quote, 5 out of every 10 people in New York City had sailed on the ship or been close to it. Not only was it the worst loss of life in New York City until 9/11, but it was about as familiar to the people as, say, Windows on the World was inside the World Trade Center.
Absolutely. Or, you know, keeping on the water, like the Circle Line. You know, most of you have heard of that. So what went wrong? What happened that day in Hell's Gate Channel? We're going to throw maps up as well. You're going to be able to really triangulate what was supposed to be the journey of this ship and what ended up being its journey. So what happened as the ship passed 90th Street? And why is the Slocum so much less remembered today than, say, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, which was a great labor disaster down a few blocks away, actually over in, right off of Washington Square Park. For one thing, the families of Little Germany, they just moved on, leaving little trace. You know, the neighborhood was blasted by this. You know, there's more of a Ukrainian influence visible today in the East Village than there is a German one, for sure. Today, the church they actually set sail from, it's a synagogue, and nobody calls it Little Germany anymore.
In fact, where we are at McSorley's, we are at a table right by the window that the bartenders were nice enough to give to us. We're right across from the table at the window where John Lennon used to sit and write. And
yep.
John Lennon didn't drink beer, but he would sit there, drink a Coke, and he would write right in these windows. So a lot of history, as we said, here at McSorley's. So the rain was very fortunate for us.
Absolutely.
We didn't have to leave McSorley's, and we got to talk to you nice people at the Saltworks. And yes, this church across the street originally was not Ukrainian. Now it is. And that was the story of New York and has always been. People come here, live, they build big communities like Little Italy. Now Little Italy is shrinking away. It's a couple of streets. And Chinatown is taken over very much as Chinese immigrants got here. But for Little Germany, the city really was cut short. It just was, some people say, in a little bit of a decline. But
yeah.
This really literally ripped the heart out of it. We can't state that enough.
Yep. It was a huge disaster, and it was a massive tragedy. And someone who had extremely close ties to this city wanted to make it his business to get some answers.
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt, he was in McSorley's, actually, and unfortunately somebody swiped the guest book that T.R. signed, but
someone whose name rhymes with Jean Parianis. No, sorry.
I would never take a historical artifact, no. I might take Woodrow Wilson's bones, but yeah.
Oh, that's a different podcast. This will be doing from Sing Sing someday. Blackwell's Island, sorry.
New York's own Theodore Roosevelt was president at the time, and he swore to get to the bottom of the disaster. There was some small justice for the dead 2 years later when Captain Van Schaik And honestly, folks, I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce his name, but since all those people died under his command, and since I have kind of a thing about people demanding their names be pronounced the right way,
right?
When I have a name with so many vowels that, you know, most kids learn to spell their name in kindergarten. I was in sixth grade. So TR, he did want an investigation. He wanted to find out why this happened. And at this time, yes, there were people on this, on the Slocum. They would put these life jackets on their children and throw them into the water and watch them sink because they were full of cork. And they said the people that made them, they would fill them with low-grade cork and then just put steel bars in them to make them heavy.
Wasn't that like the Normandy, too? Like, didn't the Normandy sink because, like, there are these ridiculous life jackets that were filled with, like, you know, sawdust that didn't work? Another maritime disaster,
yeah,
which we can get to. Sorry.
Well, and another and a thing was about the Slocum was when they built it, and as easy as we always say as it is to look back at people in history and say, oh, they screwed up, we would have known better. People said when they built it in Brooklyn, it was unsinkable.
And we've heard that before.
Yeah.
Well, you would hear that just a few years later.
Yeah. And they said it's unsinkable. It has these airtight compartments. People will believe that. And it's something that, you know, if we could learn something from history, why people ask us why we need to think of history, we could learn from this disaster. Owen's going a little later tonight, going to take a similar float on the East and North Rivers. Sorry, I'm a man of the past. I call the Hudson the North River.
It's true.
But, you know, we've all got to watch for fire exits. I had a vice principal who was, he was aboard the Forrestal, and he always made us take our fire drills very seriously. And I think without turning into Smokey the Bear, it's something we could all learn from this.
Are you kidding me? To this very day, Jack, my wife and I walk into a movie theater. It's like, all right, those exits there.
It's important, you know, and we can all learn from this because, as we said, there are people just like us, and on this ship, you can't count on the ship. You can't count on the government. You know, the government wasn't here enforcing them doing the fire drills that were required by law. And these are the kind of things that TR found. They weren't checking the life rafts. Captain Von Schenk was convicted of criminal negligence for failing to maintain the fire drills required by law. Judge Thomas sentenced Von Schenk to 10 years of hard labor at Sing Sing. They petitioned the president, Theodore Roosevelt, for a pardon, and TR told him to go pound sand. But his successor, William Howard Taft, did go along with the parole board's recommendation and free the captain. He spent just 2.5 years in jail, and he was a very old man, and I found it odd that he actually got married to a younger woman 2 years after. So, as we see now, like, the guy somehow managed to get chicks out of just being in the news.
There's some wacky types of ladies who love jailbirds. I don't know what it is. But based on the laws at the time, the Knickerbocker Steamboat Company couldn't be held liable for more than the value of the ship. Can you imagine that? And they sold it for $1,800. And you'll see the pictures of what's left, by the way. And that's what went for $1,800. The captain did lose an eye in the fire, which, you know, seems fitting. You know, there's a little romantic justice there, considering he turned a blind eye to all that was wrong on his vessel.
Yeah, even a 12-year-old boy, there's one story of him going to him. His own crew didn't tell him there was a fire on the ship till 10 minutes in. But this boy tried to warn him, and the captain just blew him off.
Well, kids should be seen and not heard, right?
Yeah, I mean, I cannot, you know, hey, there's a fire, Mr. Captain.
Right.
Shut up, kid. Don't bother me.
Yes, exactly.
By all accounts, really, though, as much as it's easy to lay it on Captain Von Schenk, this guy was beloved. He was believed to be a good captain. He didn't go down with the ship. I got to point out, he jumped off onto a tug. But, you know, this is a pleasure boat. And, you know, any one of us, if you're in this sort of routine work, you don't know, you're not ready always for disaster to happen.
Right.
And thank God on 9/11, we did have people. It was on land, obviously. We were trained. And those guys stepped up. We might have just been meter maids or whatever they were, or firemen that hadn't seen the big blaze. And they ran in when everyone else was running away. But this guy, he tried to do what he thought was right. Based on all the reading, people say, well, he didn't beach the ship. He was afraid that would cause a bigger fire.
Right. And again, it was just it just happened so quickly that the horror just was impossible to keep up with. One thing, you mentioned 9/11, when I think about this disaster, the Slocum, and you know, my knowledge of this disaster came late. I'd heard about it as a kid, you know, and but one of the things, you know, when I think about 9/11 and one of the horrors of that day was watching people with the last choice they had in life was how they were going to die. And that was going to be either they were going to suffocate or burn to death, or they were going to throw themselves out of a high window and die that way. And the very same thing happened on the Slocum. You would have mothers desperate, crazed like animals, to try to save their children. And what would they do? They would take their infants and they would fling them from the boat as they screamed for their moms. And they would disappear into the dark of the East River. You know, it's that thing. Do they burn alive, or do they meet certain death another way? Triangle Shirtwaist is the same thing, actually.
Girls in the Triangle Shirtwaist fire, hand in hand, jumping out of that building, knowing they were going to die.
That's right. And that was the thing, too. I mean, they were just, the holding of the hands was, that was a very upsetting part. But nearby us now in Tompkins Square Park, just a couple blocks away, there's a pink obelisk that sort of sits by itself. If you go into the park, what is it, at the 9th Street entrance, maybe?
Yeah, I believe it's the northwest corner. Yeah.
Anyway, you'll find it. If you're at the northern end of the park, you'll look for it and you can find it. And do find it. It's worth spending a quiet minute or two looking at it. It's pink Tennessee marble, and it's dedicated to the victims of the Slocum disaster. It was erected 2 years, 1906, by the Symphony Society of German Ladies, and it bears the words, "They are Earth's purest children, young and fair." And it features two little kids looking seaward and a lion head spout. I don't live in New York right now. I live out in Los Angeles, but whenever I am home, I make a point of at least spending a couple of quiet minutes there. It's the memory of this disaster has wedded itself to my memories of 9/11 and two absolutely horrific days in the life of my city.
It's really, when you know the stories of these places, the monuments and the plaques, these little ones in every town I know, certainly in northern New Jersey, certainly all over the South, probably the town where you are now, there's always these little monuments. In fact, in Tenafly, New Jersey, a name you might know is Glenn Miller, and he just mixed in there with a bunch of the war dead. And Glenn Miller we know because we know In the Mood, we know his songs, but these were all real people. They just weren't, lucky enough to or talented enough to left a mark on our world like Glenn Miller's music. And that's why Owen and I, whenever we come here, we don't come here just to get our bag on. We come here to remember.
Not just.
Not. Well, all right, mostly, but I know it's such a heavy thing, the Slocum,
It is, and then it's just been lost. Do you have another 5 and 5, please?
That's Owen ordering more beers.
Explain to them quickly how we order beers at McSorley's.
At McSorley's, they only serve light and dark, and I had not told Owen yet that actually the table next to us, they ordered light beers, which is not the same at McSorley's as ordering lights and darks. McSorley only serves two kinds of ale. We did not mention when McSorley's opens, but I'm looking at the date right now, 1854 in the window. McSorley's has been here ever since, and except for a brief experiment with hard liquor, they have only ever served light and dark ale. It's
yep.
made just for them.
If you want to get twisted on booze, you got a lot of other bars you can go to.
And the light beer, not the thing to order. I've been here when people have ordered Guinness. I was here one day when two young... our brother hipsters, I guess, here in the city that we have to learn to live with, like squirrels. And one of them looked behind the bar, and there's many pins hanging over the doors and over the bar, much memorabilia. The chair Abraham Lincoln sat in when he came here. And one of the little hipster kids said to the other one, "Hey, that button says Ted Kennedy for president. I didn't know he ran for president." And the other one said, "Yeah, man, he got shot."
Yeah. "Hey, and I like your girlfriend's jeans on you."
That's the kind of stuff we will not abide.
No. But back to the to wrap up a bit of the Slocum here. And this is one of these things about why the Slocum was so easy to pass from memory. There's no one left to talk about it. No one left who was there. On January 26, 2004, the last surviving passenger from the General Slocum, her name was Adela Wotherspoon. She died at 100 years old. She was the youngest survivor at 6 months old and lost both of her older sisters that day. When she was 18 months old, her mom, who was disfigured by the flames, held her up to pull the shroud off the memorial to the victims at that cemetery in Queens. 10,000 people watched through their tears as the little girl pulled off the shroud. And once the statue was revealed, little Adela reached out a finger to point at it, dropping her baby doll that she had tucked under her arm. She then said loud enough for most of the mourners to hear, "See, pretty."
I got goosebumps the first time I read that account of this little girl. And the people there that day included that man who had taken a swing at the policeman that we mentioned earlier. And he shook hands with the cop. And, of course, there was complete understanding there of why he'd been so emotional. There are so many stories like that. And as we said, it's little remembered, the Slocum, but every year at the Lutheran All-Faith Cemetery in Middle Village, Queens, a memorial is held. That's to the current day. For the victims of the Slocum, at the monument there, that this little girl dedicated. And this is also where many of the unidentified victims are buried. A representative from the German consulate attended this year to pay his respect. The horror of the shrank.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. That was them bringing us 3-3 at McSorley's. As you heard, Owen ordered 5-5, but he said it's hot out today, so these beers are going to get cold fast. They're not huge beers. And keep in mind, McSorley's is one of the only places to stay open during Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because these are really near beers.
Right.
Or so the policemen who came in were convinced to believe.
Exactly. Now, you were about to talk about our boy, Donovan Schrank.
A newspaper is hanging on the wall of McSorley's, and it's under a picture of Theodore Roosevelt, and it says, "TR shot by Crank." And that was a little play on Schrank's name there. Jonathan Schrank lived over a bar that was not too far from here on 10th Street. Unfortunately, his fiancée was on the Slocum, and she died, and he had to go identify her. And it was very heartbreaking. It really broke his heart and his mind.
Is that what pushed him over the edge?
Yeah, he said after that he would never have any girl again, would never be with any girl he wanted to marry and loved her so much. It was a really heartbreaking moment for the guy. And it really broke his mind. And even after he shot TR when he was not president anymore, but running again in 1912, people said, you know, lesser men have been broken by the disaster of the Slocum by seeing their loved ones laying there charred. And one husband identified three different corpses as his wife because they were burned so badly. That was part of the thing that drove this man really over the edge. It's terrible that he shot TR, but TR kind of shrugged it off.
TR literally shrugged it off.
Yeah.
He went up, he finished his damn speech, for crying out loud. It was a 90-minute speech.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was it? Yeah, his lead eyeglass case and 50 folded pages or something?
Yeah, and he said,
"It takes more than that to kill a bull moose."
Imagine this. You're this guy, Strank. Even as unbalanced as you are, you shoot Theodore Roosevelt, and he just goes, "Ow." And then he says, "Bring him in front of me." And the guy is shaking. And TR just looks at him real close, like a couple inches away from his face, people said. Everybody's quiet and squints. And then he goes in and he gives this speech. And when he is walking out after the speech, and one of the photographers, their flash powder exploded.
It was not backlit digital app, for sure.
Everybody ducks and, like, you know, freaks out and everything. And TR goes,
"Shot again."
What happened to the Slocum afterwards?
Well, the Hulk of the General Slocum was sold to a man named Peter Hagen, who converted it into a barge and renamed it the Maryland. It was laden with iron coke and bound from Camden, New Jersey to Newark. The old hull sprung a leak off Atlantic City, and Captain Robert Moon, who was master of the tug Hudson, he cast off the tow line after the Maryland slipped beneath the waves and turned back to rescue the three men who were tending the barge. And despite high seas, he got them all off. The wreck lay in shallow water just off Ludlam Beach, and by now it's probably sanded in or just torn apart by the surf.
They did try to find it recently, and they weren't able to find it, and that's what that quote comes from. Again, we'll link to all this. And it's also important to remember, as when we talked in the Coventry episode, about just how hard it was to shoot down those planes. In those days, not only did most people not know how to swim like we do today, there weren't these backyard pools, there was no New Jersey Turnpike and Garden State Parkway, for instance, to get to the New Jersey shore to go learn swimming. And most people did not know how to swim like we do today. In fact, again, to go back to TR, Theodore Roosevelt had this great way to teach his kids to swim. Owen and my wife and I have been out to Oyster Bay, He would take them to the end of the pier, and he would just throw them in the water.
Toss them in.
Yeah. And you would learn to swim, or you would die. That was his parent.
TR originally had 15 children, and so, yeah. Mind you, that Jack Handy deep thoughts. My father always said laughter was the best medicine, which is why I guess so many of us died of tuberculosis.
And also, look at any picture from that era, 1904.
The clothes.
They would just weigh them down, even if the life vests had been working. All that fabric.
You want an easy example of this? Take a terry cloth towel, drop it in the bathtub, and pick it up.
10 times as heavy.
We wanted to step away from McSorley's for a minute, as hard as that is for us to do, and back into our studios to just talk about one or two quick things that we really hadn't thought much about as we were sitting in McSorley's doing this.
We did some research to try to find some of the children that were lost that day, because the Slocum is a story of children.
Yep.
And one of them was that Frank Prodzicki, 12, who ran to the pilot house to warn the crew. The captain actually told him, get the hell out of here. That's the actual quote.
Right.
His mother and his four sisters, Annie, Henrietta, Gertrude, and infant Joanna, all died. So imagine that kid carrying that around.
Gee whiz.
And the important thing that we really wanted to get out of McSorley's was to say it doesn't just share a common wall with 117th Street next door.
Right.
We went back. We dug through at Ancestry.com. We found the names of the victims that were there of the Mundell family. Agnes, 64, was the matriarch of the family. She survived. She was taken to Lincoln Hospital. Lillian, 38, she was listed as missing. But from what I read, she was pulled out of the water by her hair and rescued. She's lucky she didn't have short hair.
What about Arthur?
Yeah, little Arthur Jr., 8 years old, died. And thinking about him being a little street urchin there outside McSorley's, if you read Joe Mitchell's fantastic book, McSorley's Wonderful Saloon, He tells these great stories. You know them, Owen, very well, right? And what era was he?
Well, he wrote in the 40s into the early 60s.
Yeah, he was very interesting. If you want to get the whole essay that he writes in that book, it's fantastic.
Yeah, there's a great collection called Up in the Old Hotel, which contains the McSorley story as well as just some great street-level writing about the city at that time.
Yeah, very old New York, and that was McSorley's era. And kids would run into McSorley's, and they served a free lunch in those days because various laws they tried to pass, this is before Prohibition, they would not let you buy beer if you didn't also have food. And so they would serve one pretzel and 72 beers. And the and kids like little Arthur would run into the store and, you know, jump up on the bar, grab a mouthful of food and run out. And, you know, the old men in there drinking their beer would jeer at them and tease the kids. And it was kind of a fun little adventure. And I like to think that Arthur had that kind of joy out there on 7th Street playing stickball with his friends before he met this tragic fate.
Absolutely. And it's a reminder that the place where McSorley sits was part of this neighborhood, the neighborhood that never recovered after. You know, you had another German neighborhood spring up in Yorkville uptown, and that's because it was closer to the site of the wreck. You know?
Yeah.
It's very sad. Very sad what happened and so many connections.
And it's also worth noting one of the things we discovered was after Arthur died, a man named Frank Otto moved in as a boarder with his mother and his sister, and he was a bartender.
Yep.
And, you know, he was right next to McSorley, so we're going to do a little more research on that, maybe touch on it another day. But that kind of gave us goosebumps thinking of that we had just come in and talked about McSorley's, and here this guy was living right next door with the family of one of the victims. He certainly went into McSorley's, even if he wasn't working there.
Yeah, absolutely.
As for the people who didn't do their jobs that led to this disaster, we have to mention Steamboat Inspector Henry Lundberg. He'd certified the Slocum as safe just a month earlier, and there were a ton of violations.
All right, let's return to McSorley, shall we?
To be able to be here today, first of all, to be, you know, doing a podcast with Dean in the flesh. I just keep getting lost in his eyes. It's very hard to do this.
It's not my eyes you're looking at.
It's your giant hands. But to be here, to be at McSorley's, to be in this neighborhood that was so affected by this tragedy, it's nice to be able to tell the story to a lot of people who may not know it. And thanks again for tuning in. We love that you guys seem to be enjoying this, and man, do we love to do it. Listen, my name's Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And here's to them.
Here's to the victims of the Slocum.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.